Ladies and gentlemen, it's that time. It's time for GGN Live.
For the block, boy. Take it rough.
Every day has been the same old thing. Gangry Nation, it's time for another podcast. And I thought it'd be a great idea just to bring the boss man back because I'm a little bit scared for my place here. Hosts are coming in and out, so you gotta kiss up to the boss. We got John B. here. What's going on, John?
Oh, man. You think it's a good idea to bring me aboard? I mean, I don't know what to tell you.
I'm full of good ideas. I was thinking about maybe doing some actual work, conducing work, but you know what? So you deserve another look-see.
Well, I think anytime you think bringing me aboard is a good idea, it's time to reassess your priorities.
Maybe for the Charlatan podcast, we'd have a good idea a little bit to bring you on again. But Gangry Nation's a close second, considering you work day in and day out, posting amazing content for the site, and also posting email threads on the site to get people to be interactive with this podcast. And the listeners did a great job this week of sending out questions in the comments section that we're going to get into soon. But the one topic I really wanted to talk about this week was I'm doing my reading and football, my procrastination that so many of you are probably very fond of while you're at work during the day. And whether it be guys like Bill Barnwell, who for ESPN, who used to be writing for Bill Simmons' site, Grantland, who's very analytically involved, or Football Outsiders and Aaron Schatz, or Pro Football Focus, it seems like the analytic community at large is really at odds with what the Jets did this offseason. And I just wanted to really delve into the reasons why that is. John, what's the first thing that comes to your mind to why that all these smart guys seem to be down on what the Jets have done?
You know, I think when I think about football prognostication, I don't like to do, you know, this team's going to win 10 games, that team's going to, you know, win 6, because I think it's impossible to predict what's going to happen in the season. You don't know who's going to get hurt. You know, you don't know where a team may get a lucky bounce. So the way I like to kind of look at it is you kind of group teams. You have the teams at the very bottom that you know are probably going to stink. You know, kind of like the Jets were in 2013, where, you know, even if everything bounces right for them, the team just doesn't have enough talent to have a winning record. You know, that 2013 Jets team got a lot of breaks. You know, they had a couple games that they won because an opponent committed a dumb personal foul late, and they still only got to 8-8. So I think, you know, you have your teams at the bottom. You also have your teams at the top, like New England and Seattle. You know, the teams that you know are going to be really good every single year. But I think most teams kind of fall into that middle category. I think that's where the Jets are right now, where there is not, I don't think there's a ton of difference between a lot of between the teams that go 6-10 and the teams that go 10-6. It may just be a matter of who has the most favorable schedule, who gets lucky with injuries, who has a guy who kind of exceeds expectations. And last year, pretty much everything broke Jets' way. They had an easy schedule. You know, you had a year that nobody saw coming for Ryan Fitzpatrick. And really, you know, they didn't really suffer any key injuries for guys that they couldn't afford to lose. You know, Wilkerson was the only guy who got seriously hurt, and that happened week 17, so it's the last game of the year. So I think the thought process is people are looking at that saying things are not going to line up exactly the way they did last year for the Jets. So if they see regression, you know, we'll see whether they're right. I have a couple things that make me kind of more optimistic than they are right now.
Well, tell me those things, because I could point out, it's very obvious to point out the things that the analytic community is pointing at, whether it be last year, the Jets had a very favorable schedule as they faced the NFC East and the AFC South, which were arguably the two worst divisions in football. And this year they're facing two other divisions, the NFC West and the AFC North, which look to be two very strong divisions going into the year. So that's one. And then the quarterback position, even if the Jets do re-sign Fitzpatrick, you have to expect a regression. Just watching the tape last year, it was pretty amazing. It sort of reminded me of the Mark Sanchez 2010 year, where he threw 17 touchdowns and 13 interceptions, but there were about 12, 13 other throws that very easily could have been picked off. And that's what it seemed like watching the Ryan Fitzpatrick tape. So I feel like a lot of guys are looking at that and expecting Fitzpatrick to come back down to earth in a certain sense. We're going to be positive here for a little bit. So, John, what are the other aspects that you look at that maybe guys like Barnwell aren't looking at when it comes to the Jets season coming up?
Okay, well, I'll give you three. Last year, the Jets, I believe, had the eighth best point differential in the league. And point differential is something I always look at. And in past off seasons, I've kind of used it as a pessimistic point, and a lot of people have disagreed with me. But the reason I like to look at point differential is that it essentially treats the entire season as one giant game. You know, 200-something offensive possessions and 200-something defensive possessions. The problem with looking at records to prognosticate the future, and I don't look, records really important. It's what, you know, it's what the playoffs are based on. But the problem with looking at record is that, you know, if you lose a game 40-0, it counts the same as losing a game, as winning a game 17-14. You know, you're 1-1 if you win by 3 or if you lose by 40. So it's not necessarily the greatest, just using record is not necessarily the greatest indicator of team performance. And some people disagree with this, but my rebuttal would be look at the NFL from year to year. Why are around half the playoff teams different every year if record is such a great indicator of how a team's going to do the next year? So you look at the Jets, they had the eighth best point differential in the league. I know they played a lot of lousy competition, but they also crushed this competition. You know, so is it going to be a case where instead of winning a game by 3 touchdowns, maybe the improved opponents will mean that you win it by 2 or 1 touchdowns? That's something that, you know, that's a positive you take away. On the same note, you look at the record in blowouts. And the reason you look at the record in blowouts is, you know, I try and read as much about football as I can. And I think about something I heard about the great 49ers coach Bill Walsh, who talked about the need to win games by double digits. And the reason he said that is because if you're in a one-score game, you're always one bad call from a referee away from losing the game. So you never want to put the game in the official's hands because if your team loses a game on a controversial call, everybody complains about it. But the thing is, you go in knowing that these officials stink. They could blow a costly call against you. So you never want to be in a position where an official can cost you the game. So that's the reason, you know, I kind of look at double digit wins, the record in double digit games. Last year, the Jets were 6-1 in games decided by double digits. The only game that they lost was Oakland. So it kind of goes on the same note where they were crushing some bad teams last year. So, again, you know, against better opponents, it may not necessarily be that they lose. It might be that they just win by less. And, you know, these are two things. I compare it to that 2013 team that I talked about. That team had the sixth worst point differential in the league. Games decided by double digits, they were 3-7. So, you know, last year they're 6-1 in games decided by double digits. That's 5 more wins than losses. 2013, 3-7, 4, you know, it's 4 more losses than wins. The third thing I look to is just the consistency the team had on offense last year. I believe they were the only team that scored 2 offensive touchdowns in every single game. I know Fitzpatrick is mistake prone. He locks on to one receiver too frequently. You know, he tries to fit balls in that his arm can't fit. But this offense, even in games where it wasn't good, was still putting points on the board, which was a stark difference from a number of recent Jets teams. That offense kept teams in the game. And I know Fitzpatrick's not great. I know there's a chance he regresses. But during those last, you know, those last 5 games before the Buffalo finale, he really started to seem like he was finding his groove. You know, he's comfortable in the system. He was making some really good throws. He was developing chemistry with Decker and Marshall. Now, you know, I understand the argument that the Jets are going to regress. And I think, you know, I got to be honest with you, there's a good chance this team loses more than they did last year. But there are a couple fundamentals that are strong for this team. And, you know, the other thing, I look at that Football Outsiders projection, and every year I get their preseason guide. And I go back to what I was discussing about the teams at the very top, the teams in the middle, and the teams at the bottom. And I get the feeling that Football Outsiders kind of assumes that teams are in the middle until they prove that they're not. So, you know, I think back to after Bruce Arians' first year in Arizona, I think Arizona won 10 games. Todd Bowles was their defensive coordinator in 2013. 2014, they expected Arizona to regress. They didn't. I remember after Jim Harbaugh's first year in San Francisco, again, that was a team that surprised everybody. They went to the NFC Championship game. 2012, they were expecting that team to regress. That team ended up going further. They went to the Super Bowl that year. I think at the end of the day, this is going to be an interesting year for this coaching staff. This might tell us a lot about the coaching staff, because the teams that don't regress are the teams that are well coached. I think football, more than any other sport, is where coaching matters. When it comes to, you know, developing of talent, and on your football team, you have a lot of players with limited skill sets, where, you know, they might be able to do one specific task well. So it's about designing an offense and putting a player in the role that these are little differences that, these are little areas where good coaching can make a big difference. So I guess it kind of comes down to what you think of this coaching staff. But I'm not going to guarantee that this team's going to win 10 games again. But I do think there are some points out there for more optimism than these sites are suggesting.
Right. And it's interesting that you brought up those two examples of the Niners and the Cardinals. They call that the plexiglass principle, where if a team wins a certain, usually four games more than they did the year before, that they expect a definite regression. And it sort of goes at least to me, it sort of goes at odds with the analytic community, because it's sort of a, I don't believe it until I see it again type of thing. And that doesn't really call for foresight or predictive analysis. But I understand it in terms of the Jets, just because of all the things that we mentioned with Fitzpatrick and the injuries and the schedule. But the thing that you mentioned with the coaching staff about how player development is going to be the most key thing, and how football is the sport where that matters the most. Another reason why a site like Pro Football Focus didn't like the Jets draft so much was because they took Darren Lee in the first and Hackenberg in the second, who were both two big projection type of guys, guys with tools who might not have produced as much as you would have liked in college. I liked Lee more than what PFF did, just based off the fact that he looks like what the future at the linebacker position should be, and that he could cover, that he could blitz up the middle, those traits that you hope Todd Bowles and the coaching staff will be able to mold. But it's about how much do you trust in Bowles and how much do you trust in Maccagnan. And this is another topic I wanted to get into. I trust them just based off one fact, was that they were brought in together. They were brought in together by Woody Johnson for the first time since I don't know how long. I mean, you have a better grasp on the history of the team than I do, but at least before Mangini, the last time they brought in a GM and a coach at the same time who would be on the same page. And I don't understand what took Woody Johnson so long to do it, because you look at all the good organizations, it's not just what happens on the field, it's what goes on off the field. It's an enterprise. It's not just the players. And coaching matters more than anything else in football than in any other sport. And it just boggles my mind. If you're a guy like Woody Johnson, who's supposedly such a good businessman and has to run such a big corporation, that you don't know this one simple thing, that you want your guys to be on the same page, bringing in the players and having the coaches using those players the way they want to use them. That definitely wasn't the case with Idzik and Rex. And it seemed maybe that Rex had too much of a voice in personnel decisions before Idzik got there. So my basic question to you is this regime different than past Jet regimes? And if it is, am I just being too optimistic and looking through rose is a color, but you know what I mean. I got my cliches going back and forth here. I'm just so excited that the Jets finally have cohesion in this organization. Are you on that optimistic side like I am, that you think that will lead to better player development in the future?
I would say I'm cautiously optimistic. I like a lot of what I've seen so far, but you can only go so far after 1 year. You know, I think it's one of those things where it's easy to be on the same page 1 year in, especially after you have success. You know, if this team has a bad year or two, are these guys really going to be on the same page? I don't know, but I do like what I've seen so far. As you said, I think these guys are on the same page. You look at what they did in free agency last year. They go out and sign three cornerbacks. Corners are critical in Todd Bowles' defense, and it's a stark contrast to what we saw in the 2014 offseason, where, you know, you had maybe the greatest cornerback class in history, and the Jets walk away with Dimitri Patterson. They do draft a guy on the second day of the draft, Dexter McDougal, who plays the position. And Rex Ryan, in some press conference, kind of, you know, he didn't outright say that I didn't want this guy, but he kind of hinted that this was not his choice. So I definitely think there is something to that. You look back, I think the last time the Jets hired two guys together, it was right after Woody Johnson bought the team in 2001. That's when Parcells left, and that's when Al Groh went to Virginia. So they brought in Terry Bradway as GM and Herm Edwards as the coach. And if you remember, if your memory goes back long enough, there wasn't even cohesion on that coaching staff, because what the Jets did was they brought in Ted Cottrell as defensive coordinator, and Cottrell and Herm didn't really have the same vision for the defense. They were both guys from the defensive side of the ball. Cottrell was a guy who I believe interviewed for the head coaching job and did not get it. So I think as a consolation, I think there was some sort of internal disagreement, if I remember correctly. So as a consolation to appease everybody, they brought Cottrell in to run the defense. It really didn't work out.
Yeah. It's such a joke, because I don't understand. Like, how can't you see that coming? That you interview two guys, you give the head job to one of them, and then you go to the, hey, you know what? We'll let you come on the staff also, but you'll work under him. You don't think there's going to be any animosity, any difference of opinion there? You're already starting from a place of failure. And it just shows with the past 15 years of Jets football, it just straight up just showed that. And I guess my memory goes back to then. 2000 is just about where I started becoming a Jets fan. My first Jet game I ever remember watching was 1998 with the AFC title game where Elway came back in the second round. In the second half in the AFC title game. So I don't remember what it was like before that in terms of organizational cohesion, but if that was the last time, then I guess my whole life I've just been living with a dysfunctional Jets organization. And as a Knicks fan also, it's sort of nothing new, and it just really goes to show how tortured I've sort of been with my sports fandom. I'm sure there are plenty of New Yorkers out there who share the same situation as I do. But it's really refreshing to see the Jets finally acting like a regular organization. And I had the same question to you with Woody Johnson. I mean, what took him so long?
Well, I think, you know, you go through what they went through in 2014 after you bring in Idzik, where you know, the idea is that he's going to clean things up after the circus that the team was in 2012, and it doesn't get any better. And I think failure kind of makes you sit down and reassess the way you do things. You brought in Charlie Casserly and Ron Wolf, who, you know, are seasoned football guys. They've been part of winning organizations, so they kind of, I think whenever you have a season like the Jets had in 2014, after some really bad years before it, kind of makes you reassess and think about what else you've done. You know, I think, Andrew, you've talked to me about how you're also a basketball fan. And the analogy I would use is, if you remember around 2002, 2004, the United States in basketball would send these teams to the World Championships, to the Olympics, and they'd just be the collection of the biggest names you can find. Well, on a basketball team or in an office or running a football team, any sort of organization, you need people who are able to handle certain roles, people who are able to work together. It's not just about collecting names. And I think that has been an issue with the Jets. I mean, I can't figure out how Terry Bradway survived two general manager changes. It's one thing if you have a successful run as a general manager and then you decide to step back and maybe go into a consultant role, you may still want that guy around just to bounce ideas off of him. How Terry Bradway survives two general manager changes is just beyond me. I don't really know what the inner workings of what happened, but it defies description how that happened. Yeah, you know, and I think back to when Tannenbaum took over. If I recall that correctly, what happened was there was a little bit of an internal power struggle where this was after Herm Edwards left for Kansas City. And if I remember correctly, I think Bradway, who was the GM at the time, wanted to hire Mike Tice, which, I mean, I don't think Mike Tice has been seriously considered for a head coaching position since, which tells you how good of an idea that was. And they eventually hire Mangini. And again, I mean, I don't know what happened behind the scenes. It may have just been that Bradway wanted to step away and spend more time with his family. There were some reports at the time that happened. So By the way, Tannenbaum did kind of come in around the same time as Mangini, so I guess if you want to say that was a full change, you could argue it. Then I recall, you know, they have that surprise year in 2006. It actually was, it reminds me a lot of the year the Jets had in 2013, Idzik's first year, where they entered the season and nobody is really expecting it. They're expected to be one of the worst teams in the league, and they kind of catch lightning in a bottle, and they have a surprisingly good season. And then just like in 2013, they go into that offseason flush with cap space, and you look at the roster, and you see the roster isn't very good, and you feel like that good record was kind of a mirage. And they really don't make any moves for 2007. They make one move, Thomas Theo. They bring in Thomas Jones. They trade up for Revis. They trade up for David Harris. But they largely bring the same team back. And just like in 2014, they go 4-12. Now, Tannenbaum's early draft picks were better than the early returns were better than Idzik. So there wasn't as much. Well, let's put it this way: there were no, you know, airplanes flying banners or billboards up, even though the Jets went 4-12 in the second year. And then 2008 comes, and Tannenbaum goes on a spending spree in the offseason, kind of sees, I don't know if the error of his ways would be the right way to put it, but he kind of does a 180, and they go out, they bring in Alan Faneca, Damian Woody, Tony Richardson, Calvin Pace, and then, you know, the big move was Brett Favre. And you kind of look at that, and you wonder whether Mangini was behind it, because there's plenty of talk that Mangini wasn't a big fan of bringing in Favre. Anyway, you know, 2008 comes and the team collapses at the end of the year. And, you know, the popular story is that, you know, Favre cost Mangini his job. But you look back at that team, and I was, you know, a couple of weeks ago, like, I was going back and remembering that year. I just remember this week 16 game in Seattle in a snowstorm where it was one of the worst coach games I've ever seen. The Jets have the ball on the 1 yard line early in the game. This is a bad Seattle team that they're playing. They have a chance to punch it in. Fourth and goal, Mangini kicks a field goal. Then later in the game, they're undisciplined. They have a penalty right before the field goal attempt. Jay Feely knocks it through, gets wiped off on a penalty. And Feely hit this kick with like 10 yards to spare. The penalty knocked him back 5 yards, which is inexcusable. You can't have a penalty in that spot. Feely shows he's got enough leg to make the kick from 5 yards back. Mangini punts. Seattle's entire offensive line's on injured reserve. All five starters are out. The Jets don't register a sack. Just a miserable defensive game plan. Mangini deserved to be fired. Mangini gets fired. Rex comes in. And I do think Rex and Tannenbaum were on the same page. But I feel like, in some ways, the early success they had was kind of a curse. Because in retrospect, there was a real arrogance that kind of came through the organization at that point, where you have success with guys, bringing in guys who, you know, have question marks off the field, whether it's Antonio Holmes or Braylon Edwards or Antonio Cromartie. These guys come in, the Jets have a big year in 2010. They have a lot of success with these guys. And you get the feeling Rex started to think, I can coach anybody up. You know, it doesn't matter what their character issues are, them to behave in the locker room. You know, I can figure out a way to make anybody work. So what happens? You know, they give Holmes a big extension. You know, Holmes was on his best behavior that year in 2010 because it was a contract year. Then they bring in guys like Plaxico Burress, Derek Mason, who cause problems. Rex pushes the wrong buttons. He names Holmes the captain. Then they go, you know, the next year they go out and get Tebow. It's another example of them thinking they can coach anybody up. I think Rex and Tannenbaum were kind of on the same page then. It's one thing to be on the same page. You have to be on the same page and actually doing the right things. Yeah. So you look at the early returns on these guys. I like what I've seen so far, but, you know, it's only the first year. The Jets have had other guys come in and be successful in the first year and then not work out. That said, I'm cautiously optimistic. And, you know, I do kind of feel like it's different this time. I do kind of feel like these guys have the same goal in mind. It is kind of a different scenario than what we've seen with the Jets recently.
Right. And I think the best example of that is what's going on with Fitzpatrick. McCagnan is sticking to his guns that he is not going to be overpaying for competent quarterback play. I feel that if Tannenbaum or I don't know about Idzik because I don't think that guy pays anybody, but if Tannenbaum was the GM or even Bradway, I feel like they would have caved by now with all this media pressure going on about how, oh, they're a win now team. You got Marshall, you got Decker, Revis. You have a lot of veterans on the team who want to win now. And you have this quarterback sitting on the open market who's threatening retirement because you're not paying him. I just feel like a past regime might have caved by now. And it's very nice to see that we have a GM and a regime that is sticking to what they believe in and has the foresight to not just look at last year, but to look at every other year that this guy has been playing and not pay him $14, $16 million a year. So I think that that's one example of what I like of what Maccagnan has done. And you mentioned the other example last year in free agency where it was clear that they needed to bring in talent in the secondary and they went out and did that. If there's one thing that I haven't liked that Maccagnan has done, it was probably, and this is a really nitpicking because I do like the players they brought in, but I just do find it odd. And Barnwell mentioned this in his column where he gave the Jets a D for the offseason, which I think is a little harsh, but I just think that guy just likes to be harsh in general, just, you know, clicks. But the fact that they didn't draft a running back and they spent a lot of money on running backs in free agency, especially next offseason, they have $10 million cap hit, Powell and Forte. And the thing is, Kyrie Robinson might be the best player of all three of them. So the fact that they paid those guys $10 million and still have to deal with Wilkerson and Fitzpatrick isn't the most prudent way to be spending money. If there's one thing that Maccagnan and Bowles have done this offseason that doesn't really agree with your philosophy in terms of team building, what would it be?
I think from a big picture perspective, I'm a little concerned with his tendency to trade draft picks for veteran players. And, you know, it's one of those things. I think he's traded four late round picks for veteran players right now. And I think, you know, if you look at these things individually, you're always going to be able to defend a move like that because the odds of hitting on a late round pick are not that great. I mean, who's going to complain when you trade for Brandon Marshall or, you know, Fitzpatrick? But I just think collectively it concerns me a little bit because to be successful in the NFL, you have to have young guys who are making tiny amounts of money contribute on your team. You know, that's not necessarily be a star, not even necessarily a starter, but productive role players. And the best way to hit on lower round picks, a lot easier to hit on lower round picks when you have a lot of them. So, you know, I'm not sure, maybe I'll rephrase that. I'm not sure it's necessarily trading away late round picks, but I feel like you have to figure out a way to replenish them, whether that's trading down more or building compensatory picks into your free agency strategy. Because if you have, you know, you may say, well, your odds are lower of hitting on a guy in the fifth round. Your odds are lower hitting on the guy in the sixth round. But if you have a fifth round pick, a sixth round pick, a seventh round pick, you know, maybe add an extra one at some point, it's a lot easier to find somebody. And you can make up for that if you hit on undrafted free agents. But it's just something I don't want to make too much out of it. But I am a little worried about the way Maccagnan values his draft picks. And even, you know, the trade for Brandon Schell. And I think the justification for that is you think Brandon Schell is going to be an outstanding talent. That concerns me because, you know, you're going to get to next year. I promise you what's going to happen after the first 2 days of the draft, because it's happened every single time the Jets traded a pick in the history of the site, is that some guys are going to fall out of the first three rounds. And people are going to say, man, I really wish we had that fourth round pick. So I guess it's just, you know, the one thing I'd like to see him do is if you're going to constantly trade picks for veterans, I'd like to see you figure out a way to recover those picks. You think we're getting a compensatory pick. But if you look at the teams that really have had the most success in the NFL in the draft, especially in the late rounds, are the teams that stockpile their picks. And when you have a lot of those picks, it makes it a lot easier to trade one because you can say, all right, well, I still have my full allotment of lottery picks. And, you know, everybody talks about building through the draft. Well, to be successful, you have to hit on your draft pick. So I guess that's the one thing that concerns me a little bit about the Cavs. And, look, I don't want to make more out of it than it is because I'm cautiously optimistic about this guy.
Well, yeah, Maccagnan did trade down last year in the draft with Houston, and he picked up a couple of picks. So it's not like he's completely opposed to it. And, yeah, I would have really liked to see him trade down this year, especially at number 20, because – there were clearly teams that wanted to get up there and take receivers. I feel like maybe you could have gotten Lee at 23, 24, maybe trade down with a team like the Vikings or the Texans if they wanted Dotson or Fuller, whoever those receivers were. But in general, I think, yeah, we are nitpicking here, and it sort of seems like the organization is headed in the right direction. And reading through the comments section, it seems that most of the website sort of agrees. They're going to be guys who are just going to complain no matter what the Jets do, just because they just love to complain and have their voices heard. But it seems to be that most of the Jets fandom and the gang and Gangrene Nation sort of agrees the direction the organization is going in. That was sort of my attempt to segue to the comment section, to the emails. So might as well just get right to it. We asked you guys to send in some questions for the podcast. And it's very interesting because a couple of the questions were actually on my mind too. And the first question that I want to get into, and John, we're going to go back and forth. I'm going to ask a question. We're going to talk about it. And whatever question you want to talk about, you can throw it out there. But the first thing that came to my mind was also the first question that I read. And this is from Crackback, who, shout out to Crackback. He writes for the site here and there. And he's also basically comments on every article that's there. So props to you, man. But he goes, what player can we least afford to lose significant time to injury? I'll answer this first. I think it's clear. I think it's Brandon Marshall. And the evidence for that would be last year when the Jets lost Decker for those couple of games, whether in the Eagles game or when he was limited. And I forgot which other game he was limited in, but he was limited in a couple other games, and the Jets lost that game too. And they had the best receiver duo in football, but if you take one of those guys out, then the defense just gets to settle in on that number one target. But if you have Marshall and Decker, then you sort of have two options, and you get to move them around, one in the slot, one on the outside. But if Decker hurt us that much last year with his injury, I can only imagine what would happen if Brandon Marshall went out. There are a couple other guys I look at too, but John, do you go Marshall or you go with somebody else?
Well, first of all, I'd like to say, if you are one of those people who complains about everything, we love you. Keep clicking on the site. You know, we like at SB Nation, we like our traffic, so we love you. I think Marshall's the guy, you know, if you take Marshall off, it just becomes a very, you know, it becomes a lot like the receiving that they had in 2014, where, you know, Decker's the kind of guy you could take away if you want to. Marshall's the type of guy where even if you scheme to take him away, he's still going to get his. Yeah, that game against the Eagles where Decker missed, Marshall did not have a very good game. And the Jets, I don't think the Jets were very efficient throwing to him, but he still put up numbers in that game. You know, I think it's the question, though, is I don't think there's just one player the Jets can't afford to lose. I think there are a lot of guys where it would be a big loss. So I think, you know, we were talking before the show, you know, preparing for this yesterday, and you named a number of guys. You named Revis, you named Mangold and Clady. And those are guys where they just don't have good backups. I think losing Decker would be important just because, I mean, this is a Jets receiving group that really depends on its top two guys. So I do think they definitely missed him in that Eagles game. I think it's a different game if he plays. So, you know, those guys are all pretty indispensable. You know, Revis is not the same guy he used to be, but at the same time, Revis goes down. You really want Marcus Williams or Buster Skrine matching up one-on-one against A.J. Green week one? I know I don't. You know, last year, Pryor missed time. You know, it's actually a big loss. You know, I don't know that this guy is never necessarily going to be an all-pro type player, but he's an important part of the defense on the back end. You know, I think his range really helps them. If anything breaks down, he's there to kind of save the day. And then, you know, anybody on the offensive line, they just don't have any proven offensive line depth. They have a lot of young guys who you're hoping can step up, but you don't really know what there is. I mean, honestly, I'm not even that confident in the starting group, so you take a Mangold or a Clady, and Clady is, you know, given Clady's recent injury history, I'm kind of scared. I think those would be that's a pretty solid list of guys that you really don't want to see the Jets lose. Obviously, you don't want to see the Jets lose any defensive linemen, but there's just so many quality young players. It would be easier to weather the loss of one of those guys. You know, Jets missed Sheldon Richardson the first four games last year, but they were able to get through that just because of the depth and talent they have.
Yeah, and it sort of scares me because you sort of brought up Clady. I mean, you look at Pryor also, and you look at Mangold. These are, I mean, Mangold got hurt last year, but he's usually healthy. But especially Clady and Pryor, those are guys that their playing style and their history sort of suggest that injury isn't something that you just completely rule out going into the year. I'd be very, very worried, especially because of the injury luck that the Jets had last year, that if it's going to happen again this year. What direction do you want to go in next, John?
All right, I'll ask this one. I thought this was a really good one. It asks, what is the philosophy behind the Steelers strategy that Mack and Bowles have adapted of establishing a long-term depth chart of edge rushers? I get it's the most important position on D and all, but there's generally only edge rushers at most on any snap and mostly one. Most of these guys can only rush on obvious passing situations. That references some comments Mike Maccagnan made in the past about how the Jets have studied the Pittsburgh Steelers, who also run a 3-4 base defense. And the Steelers have constantly drafted outside linebackers. So I guess I'll start with this. I think that's a great question. The answer is manyfold. I think the first thing is it's the most important position on the defense the Jets run. I think it's the most important position in any defense. You know, sometimes it'll be called a defensive end. Sometimes it'll be you'll hear it called a hybrid. Sometimes you'll hear it called an outside linebacker. But the edge is where most of the pass rush is generated. You know, even when you have great interior guys like the Jets do, it's difficult to generate those pass rushing numbers. Just look at the numbers the Jets have put up. You know, the Jets have guys who are top interior rushers, but generally they're not putting up the same pressure number. I know Wilkerson had 12 sacks last year, but they aren't putting up the same consistent pressure numbers as other defenses that have those elite edge rushers. So I think the first reason you do it is that you always want to have depth there. Because if your first guy gets hurt, you want to have somebody who can step in and play well. You know, in recent years under Rex Ryan, the Jets had really good defenses, but it was despite the lack of an edge rusher. So you might be led to believe it's not important. But at that point, they also had Revis in his prime. You know, Revis in his prime may have had the type of value of an edge rusher. But in general, I think good edge rusher equals great anything else. And I think to have the value of an edge rusher, you actually have to be as good as Revis was during those years from 2007-9 to 2011. So the first thing you want is you want depth on the edge. And the second is that you need to think long term. You know, you draft a guy, he's not always going to produce as a rookie. You're thinking more years 2, 3, and 4. Well, eventually that guy is going to hit free agency. And look at some of the free agent contracts that are given out. You know, one example I'd use is Vernon, who signed with the Giants. That guy's not really a big-time pass rusher. I know he's had some good stretches. I know some of his PFF numbers are really good. But you're telling me Vernon's one of the best pass rushers in the NFL? Well, look at the contract he got. I mean, it's inevitable you're going to eventually lose guys, pay them ludicrous amounts of money. So you always want a young guy ready to step in and take that spot. And again, that's just because this is such an important position on the defense. So you always want to have a stable of young linebackers in this particular defense, the guys who can come off the edge and generate a pass rush.
Right. And I think that's a good example of quantity over quality and what we were talking about and sort of wanting to have a good amount of draft picks, because GMs sort of overrate their ability to evaluate talent. And the more bullets you have in the chamber, the more likely you are to hit. But I like the way the Jets are doing this now. It seemed like in the past, they kept ignoring that position. Every mock draft you would read would have the Jets taking some type of outside pass rusher in the draft. And it would just never happen. And I would never understand it. They did take a guy last year. And that brings me to the next question is, which single player, if they exceed beyond expectations, turns the Jets into a bona fide contender? And to me, that guy is Lorenzo Maldon. They haven't had an outside pass rusher like him. I would say even Calvin Pace, when he first came in, I mean, he was pretty good. But he was more of an edge setter. I would say John Abraham would be the last time they had a guy on the edge who was able to bring pressure and supplement the rush they got up the middle. If Maldon could turn at second half of the year last year, where he was playing on the line, he was playing off the line, he was bringing a lot of pressure, he didn't necessarily get the sacks that you would like to see. He had 4 of them, but bringing pressure with hits and hurries. And if he could turn into 8 to 10 sack type of guy who brings pressure consistently, I think that really turns this Jets defense into something that they haven't had in a long time, which is they have the pass rush and they have the talent in the secondary. There are other guys on this roster that I think that might be able to be examples for this question. I think Geno Smith is the easy answer, but I don't think a large portion of the fan base would want to find the answer to that question if Geno could actually get playing time. But is there another guy besides Maldon, or do you agree with me?
I agree with you. I think, you know, any of the young quarterbacks, whether it's Geno, Petty, or Hackenberg, if any, it's always about the quarterback in the NFL. So, you know, one of the quarterbacks, or even, you know, even we're talking about Fitzpatrick, the likelihood of regression. So if Fitzpatrick comes back and has another year like he did last year, that takes the Jets to another level. But I'm going to assume that the quarterback position is off the table for the purposes of this discussion. And yeah, it's the edge rusher, it's mauled. And, you know, when we're talking about rookie players, I always like to keep my expectations low. What I like to see in a rookie is I like to see a guy who looks like he belongs, you know, a guy who doesn't look overwhelmed. And that's what you got out of Baldwin last year. So did Baldwin look like a superstar last year? No, but he looked like a guy who could play in the NFL. So I'm excited to see what he can do. I think I agree with you. If Baldwin becomes, you know, a 10 sack guy, some guy like that, could be a top five defense when you consider the talent they have on the interior.
Yeah, for sure. And that does make up for the loss of Damon Harrison. I mean, yeah, he's more of a run stuffing guy, but just to have talent in the front seven to sort of replace him will really help. Is there a question that you would like to get to, or do you want me to choose another one, John?
I'll take one. So there's a question, what's the scoop about Vanderland? Will he see the field this year? And Vanderland was an undrafted free agent. I think he was a Division II quarterback who's converted to tight end. I think the question with him is going to be, does he show enough to get a spot on the practice squad? I would be floored if this guy made the 53-man roster. He's not only transitioning, let's think about the jump in talent from where he's coming from, the small college he's coming from, to the NFL. He's also learning the basics of a new position. He has to learn the technique of tight end. He has to learn how to deal with contact, running routes, catching balls. So this is going to be a long-term project. He has to show enough in preseason to earn a spot in the practice squad. I don't think he's going to be on the field this year.
I don't really have much to say about him. I really can't really come up with anything substantial or anything memorable to say about him, but the tight end position as a whole is going to be very interesting the way the Jets run it again. Because last year they were sort of using Quincy Enunwa as their tight end. I really like the upside he has. I think that play in Dallas just shows you the potential that he has. The play where he caught bubble screen and just zoomed up the sidelines. Like he went 0 to 60 in like half a second. That explosiveness is really hard to find, that size and speed. And he's actually a good answer to our question of which single player, if they exceeded expectations, would turn them to a contender, just based that they'll have another option in the passing game. How confident are you that he is going to be able to take that next step? Or do you think that they're going to have to rely on Jason Morrow to show that promise that he showed in the rookie year?
Well, there was no bigger fan of Jason Morrow as a college prospect than me, so I'm still an Morrow guy. I'm very optimistic about him. Again, this was another guy. I think he caught something like 38 balls his rookie year. I mean, he wasn't, you know, he didn't look like a star tight end. But no tight end comes in, tears the league apart as a rookie. You know, he's a guy who looked like he belonged that rookie year. I'm interested to see what he can do. I also am intrigued by Enunwa, though. So I think this tight end position is a real wild card for the Jets because you have a couple of really you don't have anybody who's proven. You have a couple of really intriguing internal guys. Enunwa, I think, was a bigger part of the run blocking game, the success of running the ball as a blocker than people realized last year. He's very mobile. He allowed them to do some creative things formation-wise because of just how well he moved, how much ground he could cover to throw a block. And near the end of the year, he definitely did kind of flash some playmaking skills as a receiver. He had that big catch in overtime against New England. The issue with Enunwa is, can he hold on to the ball? He was a guy who did not have a great reputation. He didn't have a reputation for having great hands. If I recall correctly, coming out of Nebraska, he dropped a lot of balls last year. I think he dropped one, you know, right before that catch in overtime. He dropped a big one in the fourth quarter. I remember he had a big drop in the season finale against Buffalo. So I guess the question is, can if the ball hits him in his hands, can he pull it in?
Right. And drop passes are definitely an issue in general when it comes to receivers, but I also think they're overstated. Yeah, of course you want the guy to catch the ball, but it's sort of, what's the worst case scenario if you're a guy, the ball, it's an incomplete pass, right? I mean, again, I'm not advocating for guys to drop the ball when they're thrown to them. But I also think that if you're going to have a negative to a guy's skill set, I would have that be it more than the guy can't run or he's not strong enough. Because Enunwa has the tools. Maybe you just throw him in front of the jugs machine every day for 3 hours, and then he sort of learns how to catch the ball. But I really like the promise that he showed last year. And you're right, he really helped the running game last year. They'd send him in motion, and he'd sort of throw some type of crackback block where he'd set the edge and allow Ivory to get to the outside. Just the fact that he's so big and he's so versatile is very conducive to what Chan Gailey wants to do on offense. So that brings me to my next question. How do you expect the carries to be split between the running backs? And do you think the Jets offensive line may eventually switch to a zone blocking scheme, which is what Chan Gailey ran in Buffalo? That's from DMAC 17. The first thing I want to talk about is the zone blocking scheme. A sign of a good organization is that they tailor their scheme around their talent and not vice versa. One of my pet peeves when Mangini came in at first was that we have to run the 3-4, no matter that, even though Jonathan Vilma is our best player on defense, we're gonna run something that won't utilize his talents in the way that it should be. They ended up trading him. They ended up getting, I got a second round pick for him. But anytime a coach comes in and says, I'm the number one, I'm the most important thing here, it sort of rubs me the wrong way because you're not on the field. And Ryan Clady thrived in the zone blocking scheme in Denver, and he sort of struggled once they went to that man scheme. And it really wouldn't surprise me if they went back to it just based off personnel. I think Bowles and McCagnon and Chan Gailey are smart enough to know and have been in the league long enough to know that they should be tailoring their scheme around their talent and not just sticking to their guns.
Yeah, one of the reasons, I was a lot higher than a number of people were on the Chan Gailey hire, just because Gailey is a very adaptable guy. He's not, doesn't really have any set idea of what he wants to run. Mangini is a great example. And the thing that made no sense about Mangini is, he was a Belichick disciple, and Belichick's never been married to a given system, so that just made no sense. I think to answer the question about the zone blocking, it's tough to answer because I don't know who the starters are going to be on the right side of the line. I guess at this point, you probably think Giacomini's coming back, but I still see a scenario where he's not. I'm not sure who the right guard's going to be. So I think that it depends on that. I think it is conceivable we can see some more zone stuff this year. And, most teams, it's a mix of man and zone. There are only a handful of teams that are strictly one or the other. As far as the running backs go, I think Forte and Powell are going to be kind of 1 and 1A. I think a lot of people are expecting Forte to be the top guy, and I do think he'll probably see most of the work, but Powell got the amount of money that leads me to believe that he's going to be a big part of the mix. I think Robinson will spell the two guys here or there, and he'll get some work if anybody gets banged up or anything. Maybe you'll see some short yardage goal line situations, but I think the start of the year, it's going to be Forte and Powell roughly splitting the carries.
I wouldn't be the biggest fan of that, but I'm a big Kai Robinson guy, and I think he has the skill set to thrive on the early downs. But what I think that these moves sort of show is that the Jets are going to be throwing the ball a lot. And on early downs, late downs, you just watched the film last year. They did throw the ball a lot more than a lot of people expected them to. But if you have Powell and Forte in the backfield in every play, you have the option to run or throw. And that was the difference when they had Ivory last year, because when Ivory was on the field, there was like an 80% likelihood the Jets were running the ball because they'd rather have Powell or another running back on the field if they were going to throw. So the fact that they have Forte and Powell sort of gives them that option that they didn't have last year. So I do like that aspect of it. You have Robinson on your team and he shows and he's a better runner than Forte or Powell are, then I think that there's a risk of underutilizing him. And I would really like to see what he looks like in the preseason, give him a lot of carries, because we already sort of know what Forte and Powell can do. So if Robinson shows a lot in preseason, then it wouldn't shock me that he has a bigger role than a lot of people are expecting.
I would love to see it. I like Robinson a lot. I think he's going to – my prediction is that he's going to prove to be an excellent signing. So I would be very happy if you're right.
Well, yeah, and that my one issue with the Robinson signing, out, it was only a one-year deal. Maybe that's what Robinson wanted to sign in the first place, that he wasn't willing to go more than 1 year. But, yeah, I could really see him thriving in this system the way Ivory did and cashing in next offseason. John, do you have time for one more question, or do you have to bounce?
Sure. No, sure. Well, let's do one more.
All right. So what unit besides the quarterback position needs to improve their play the most in order for the Jets to take the next step? Besides the quarterback position that he throws out there. I'm sorry, I didn't have the guy who sent that in. Actually, no, there we go. Fly Like a Jet. Fly Like a Jet asked that question. So what unit besides the quarterback position needs to improve their play the most in order for the Jets to take the next step?
That's what we've been discussing, edge rusher. It's the most important spot on the defense. Yeah, I know the Jets have a rough game defensively. You'll always see comments on the site about how the defensive line is overrated. I totally disagree with that. I think if you look at the numbers, the defensive line is producing just fine for interior guys. What they've lacked is that guy who can beat the tackle one-on-one and get to the quarterback, because that's where most of your pressure is going to come from. That's the thing that's going to take this defense to the next level. It's not, you know, Muhammad Wilkerson had a great year last year. Leonard Williams looked great for a rookie. I expect him to improve this year. Shelton Richardson's terrific. Can't get to the quarterback. It's not necessarily that the defensive line's not doing its job. It's that they're not getting any pressure from the edge. And, you know, we've discussed it. They just have – I'm happy to see that they're finally addressing this, because they went years and years and years for happy with guys who, you know, not only were not going to be impact players, but guys who really – you knew that they were going to be mediocre. You know, you think about that 10-sack season Calvin Pace had in 2013, but that was kind of an aberration. I mean, there are lots of plays where you just were a coverage sack, or somebody blew a blocking assignment, and you got to the quarterback untouched. It just needs some impact for off the edge. So hopefully Maldon really emerges this year.
Right, and that's sort of a bad job by me by picking that question, because, yeah, I think the edge rush is definitely the spot. But he does mention besides the quarterback position. So if I can't pick the quarterback position, I'm just going to take the two spots that will help compensate for the quarterback position. That'd be the offensive line and the receiver group. So, I mean, we've beaten the offensive line to death. That, yeah, they need more talent, and they need Clayton and Mangold especially to stay healthy. And they need guys, whether it be Brent Quail, Jarvis Harrison, Dakota Dozier, any of those young guys that they've taken in the past couple of drafts, they need them to step up and fill that hole at right guard or right tackle. But the thing that I look at is that the Jets need to maintain the production they got from the receiving core last year. And that just means Marshall and Decker staying healthy. But if a guy like Inunua or maybe Sharon Peake, if he could come in and be that guy who takes the top off the defense, or Devin Smith, isn't going to happen early in the year because he's coming out from the ACL. But if he could provide something in the second half, then I think that could really take them to the next level. But just very quickly, You mentioned the front seven. This is a question I probably should have chosen, and it's sort of a lot of guys on the site wanted to see it answered. So how do you think the front seven will be best utilized? And like, what formation, which guys, like what do you think Bulls should be doing?
Well, I think it's in today's day and age, it's more the front six, because teams are playing nickel so much. Really, in the NFL, the base defense is a nickel defense. So we're talking about a front six. I like to see our three young first-round stars all play together. You know, three-man line: Wilkerson, Richardson, Wilkerson, Richardson, Williams. And you know, I think it's one of those things where I think there's not enough imagination when it comes to utilizing talent up front. People think they're going to miss Damon Harrison. When I say, you know, you want to put somebody on the nose tackle, like either Wilkerson or Richardson, it doesn't necessarily mean I want them to do the exact same thing Harrison did. Harrison was your traditional two gap, you know, hold the point of attack nose tackle. I would put, you know, either Richardson or Wilkerson on the nose more. But what I'd have them do is kind of one gap, just have them get up the field and penetrate. And that's another way you draw double teams, is just have a guy, send the guy out there not to hold the point of attack, but send them out there to shoot through a gap and make plays. You know, look at that Denver defense. It's run by Wade Phillips. Wade Phillips has made a career out of running a 3-4 defense that in many ways resembles a 4-3 defense, where he's not asking his big linemen to just battle to a stalemate and keep the linebackers clean. He's asking his linemen to go out there and make plays. So I like a 3-man line with our 3 first-round picks. And then, you know, you'll throw Maldon in off the edge, and then you'll mix the linebackers in. You know, you'll have Harris will be a 3-down player for the team this year probably. Aaron Henderson will start out as the other linebacker. And then you kind of mix and match. You'll throw some Darren Lee in there, maybe on some early downs against run-heavy teams. You put McClendon in there. Yeah, you'll mix your personnel, but I like that. I like that as a front six, our three first-round linemen, Maldon, and then the two linebackers, Harris and Henderson.
Yeah, see, I agree with you. I just think you just want to get your talent on the field, the best talent that you have on the field. And that 3-man line with either Maldon as a wide nine end or as a guy coming off the edge in a 2-point stance is a guy that is very versatile and should really help the Jets get some pressure on the quarterback. And having Darren Lee be that guy in the middle of the defense who you don't know is going to drop back. Is he going to drop back and cover my tight end, or is he going to come screaming up the middle? I think he brings a dimension that the Jets haven't had in the front seven or front six, as you would term it, in a long time. But that's going to end it for today. We really appreciate you guys sending in your comments. We didn't get to nearly enough of them, and we're going to get to a lot of them on future podcasts, but that shouldn't stop you guys from emailing us or commenting on the blog post that we're going to throw this podcast on. So keep them coming. We really enjoy the interaction with you guys, and really smart questions, and hopefully you enjoyed the answers. We're going to try and get a new feed set up for this podcast because it sort of seems like the GGN live feed is outdated. So for now, you can find us on gangrenation.com, on blogtalkradio.com, and soon we're going to get the iTunes feed set up this week. You can find a Stitcher feed, everything else going on. We appreciate you guys listening. And John, you have any last words for your adoring public?
Guys, have a great week.
Very succinct. I like it.
Adding the choice of a crispy chicken BLT to Wendy's 4-for-4 is the biggest thing since rappers trying to sing.
I got me a yacht and I sound like a robot.
But do you like the sound of this? Wendy's 4-for-4 now comes with a choice of a junior bacon cheeseburger or a crispy chicken BLT.
From Detroit to Macon, I keep it crisp like bacon.
Both are topped with crispy applewood smoked bacon and come with 4 nuggets, fries, and a Coke for just $4.
Oh, yeah.
At participating Wendy's for a limited time, meal includes small fries and a drink, not valid in Alaska and Hawaii.